Tommy T, you just missed the craziest of crazies. Clubs, girls, dancing, naked, mom, argument, police, fleeing the scene, hiding in a dumpster, coming here, crashing on your couch for a week because technically I'm homeless.
Welcome to our 50th episode extravaganza with Jean Ralphio himself, the one and only Ben Schwartz. It's the last laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. Today on the show, we're having our very own solo bolo with Ben Schwartz. Ben has always been one of my favorite comedic actors and improvisers, from his hilarious appearances on the Comedy Bang Bang podcast to his breakout role as Jean Ralphio on Parks and Recreation, and so much more. This month, he's starring in two wildly different movies. On one end of the spectrum, he's the voice of Sonic the Hedgehog. On the other, he takes on his most dramatic role yet, as a struggling stand-up comedian opposite his childhood hero Billy Crystal in a really sweet new indie film called Standing Up, Falling Down. That one hits theaters and on demand this Friday. I had an absolute blast talking to Ben about how he arrived at this pivotal moment in his career and what comes next, including a version of his live improv show with Silicon Valley's Thomas Middleditch for Netflix, and the upcoming series Space Force, also on Netflix, in which he stars as a character clearly inspired by Anthony Scaramucci, opposite Steve Carell. I seriously cannot wait for that one. Whether you've listened to all 50 episodes of The Last Laugh or are just joining us for the first time today, please help us out by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can also go to ratethispodcast.com/laugh to rate this podcast wherever you listen. But I am not going to make you wait any longer for this wonderful conversation with Ben Schwartz.
We're going to get real comedy questions, right? You're going to ask like real comedy.
Yeah, we're going to get real comedy.
Yeah.
You
look good. You look very clean.
Oh, good.
Your beard is trimmed. Your head's shaved. Everything is perfect right
I'm
now.
I'm more trimmed than I usually am. Usually it's a little bushier.
Yeah.
But I tried, you know, for you.
You're usually a little jungle to jungle. You're a little, Do you know that reference?
Jungle to Jungle? No.
There's a movie called Jungle to Jungle, I believe. It's about someone that's in the jungle, I think. Am I wrong with Brendan Fraser?
George of the Jungle. Hold on. That what it's called?
Jungle to Jungle. Oh, okay, never mind. It's a Tim Allen movie. I was way off.
Jungle, that does look, the poster looks
George
very familiar.
George of the Jungle is probably what I was aiming
George
for.
George of the Jungle is Brendan Fraser,
that's
I believe.
That's correct. I went George of the Jungle and came up Jungle to Jungle.
So, yeah, I mean, I know you've been doing all this Sonic press, and I definitely want to talk about that, too, but I wanted to start with Standing Up, Falling Down.
I would love that.
Got to see that.
You did?
Yeah, I got to see the screener.
What'd you think?
I loved it. It's so good, man.
I haven't been able to talk about it anywhere. This makes me very happy. Thank you for bringing it up.
And this will come out, I think, the few days before it premieres in theaters.
Please. I'm very happy how much press we were able to do for Sonic, but it also, when you have an interview, it's so funny when you have, like, a big old movie.
Yeah.
I went to London, Miami, New York twice, LA, and like really worked our butts off. And then an indie movie, the whole budget of the movie was $1.5 million or whatever. Yeah. I don't know what it is. You know what I mean? So like when it comes time to do press, there's no money for press.
Yeah.
So this makes me very happy. I'd love to chat about it.
Yeah. It's a really great movie. It's you and Billy Crystal are the stars.
And he's amazing in it.
Yeah. He's really great. He's like doing a whole sort of darker character than he normally does.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're doing something more serious than you normally do, but it's also very funny. And you play a stand-up comedian or a struggling stand-up comedian in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was sort of the origins of this project? How did it come to you, or what was the story there?
Very happy we're talking about it. So it started with Peter Hoare wrote the script. He's from Long Island, New York. A guy named Matt Ratner directed it. And what happened was that they got Billy interested, and then Billy had the opportunity to choose who gets to be the star opposite him.
Oh, really?
And so they gave him a couple names, and he just really connected with my stuff. He said he knew I could be funny from some of the stuff, but I did a short film with Ben Berman, which maybe you guys know.
He just did the documentary he just did.
On The Amazing Jonathan.
I really liked,
who I was obsessed with as a kid. I love The Amazing Jonathan.
That documentary is wild.
It's insane. It's great. But he directed me in a short film called I'm a Mitzvah that went to Sundance a long time ago. And Billy got his hands on that and saw that. And it's kind of a dramatic
That's what kind of convinced him.
And he's like, oh, you can do the comedy, but you can also do drama. And then we met. And he said, this is the guy. And he said, I want Ben for it. Wow. And they said, great.
That's an insane honor.
It is. It was ludicrus. What did, I'm a huge Billy Crystal
What did
fan.
He mean to you growing up? Because, I mean, we're around the same age, and I think he's like,
how old are you?
Was pretty big.
You're younger than me.
35.
Yeah, you're like a little baby. I'm 76 years
oh,
old.
Wow. Yeah. I was way off.
76 years young. I am 38. He was, you know, if you watch, the Oscars just happened yesterday.
Yeah.
We're recording this.
Yeah.
So, like, Oscars are just, you think of him, and then City Slickers was enormous, and then I was a big NBA fan. Yeah. He did some movies that had NBA players in it. So for me, and then I think When Harry Met Sally is kind of like a perfect film.
Were you a big Comic Relief guy?
Oh, you know what's funny? I never got to see a ton of it, but I knew about it. I was like young.
That was like my favorite thing when I was growing up.
It's amazing. I've been asking him for a shirt that says Comic Relief. Yeah. I love vintage shirts.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, can I get a shirt that says Comic Relief?
I would always get the shirts because it would be like you donate.
Yeah, when you donate, you get the shirt.
Yeah.
But they raised so much money, and it was for a homeless effort?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. And it was him and Whoopi Goldberg and Robin Williams.
And the three of them just worked their butts off and made millions towards the aid of homeless people.
That was a cool show.
It's incredible, yeah. But all that stuff was... you know, he's like a legend. He started off as stand-up, and then like he did some stuff on SNL. I don't think he was a cast member, was he?
He was briefly a cast member. I think it was
Christopher Guest was there.
That one weird year with him and Christopher Guest, and
yes. And then he got soap, and then he just exploded. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
So what was it? So when you met him for the first time, had you met him before?
I had never met him before. I went to his office, and in his office, it's in Santa Monica, and in it, the saddle from City Slickers is there, sitting there. Yeah, and then you look to the left, and there's pictures of, you know, there's cool, he has cool versions of posters of movies he's done, like the French version or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's gorgeous. His office is great. And then, like, to the left, it's pictures of him and his friends.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like, it's crazy, because his friends are the most famous people you've ever seen in your life. But it's like in cool moments in his life, and I saw him for the first time, and he was Billy Crystal, because I've seen his face so many times. And for a second, you're just like, oh my God, that's Billy Crystal. Like, there's nothing you can do. And I was like, oh my God, that's Billy Crystal. And then we started talking, and like, then he became a person, and he's a human being. And then I was able to, it was great. We connected immediately. And we've become very close. I've gone to basketball games with him. We hang out. Birthday stuff we do together. He's I feel very lucky to have met him, because he's like a part of my life now.
Are you currently sexually active?
What?
Sexually active.
You think there's an STD in my arm?
Well, you know.
No, I haven't been going around fisting strangers. I don't just find somebody and stick that would be my entire fucking forearm in there.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's good to know.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just a question I have to ask. That's all.
Yeah. No, I haven't had sex in a while. I haven't had sex in like a couple.
Okay. Okay. Duly noted.
And he has this very mentor role for you in the movie.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is kind of, I imagine, paralleled in real life to some degree.
All I did, I think, whenever I've been very lucky where I've worked with a lot of people who I've looked up to, like did a movie with Jeremy Irons and Don Cheadle, and just did something with Malkovich and Carell. And I always just listen as much as I can, because they've done everything. They've literally done everything.
Yeah.
So I'll listen. He'll say like these little tidbits, or I'll watch him work, or we'll find a way that we work well together. Like before each scene, we'd go over it a couple times and maybe improvise a little bit before. So when we're ready to go, we're ready to go. Because in independent movies, there's no time. So while we're changing, we would kind of do the scenes.
Yeah.
That's another thing. He doesn't ever have to do an independent movie. You know what I mean?
He did this because he wanted to do
That's exactly right. Yeah. So it made me want to do it. And then before we said yes, after we both said we might do this, we asked if we could help with the script a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Hoare, who was the writer, said okay. Matt said okay. And we gave a whole bunch of notes. Peter came back and we wrote with him a tiny bit, and it came out. I think it's a really like good movie.
Yeah.
It's funny because it's coming 6 days after Sonic.
Yeah.
So it's hard to make sure people notice it, but I hope
people
do.
No, I mean, and you play a stand-up in it, as I said,
do.
Which did you ever do, you did stand-up very briefly?
I did. You definitely researched. You're very kind. You're a very kind person.
But I know, you're obviously known for improv and you know, comedy in general. But yeah, so did you...
Did
so
you
what
stand-up?
Was your? No, I don't do stand-up. But
you never
tried it? I'm just a big fan. I'm too scared. I think I would.
Do you want to? Is it a thing?
No, I don't really want to. But I talk to so many stand-ups that I all of a sudden I'm like, should I be doing stand-up? But no,
just because
I don't.
It's been said, talked about. That's like any time.
But no, I don't really have any desire to do it. But I also am too scared to do it. If that makes sense. But
you're also petrified of doing it.
Yeah, it does seem very scary. Was it scary for you when you
stand-up?
Yeah,
when I did it for the first time.
Yeah,
terrifying.
Yeah,
I mean terrifying. I went up at Boston Comedy Club in New York. I had my jokes. I just got out of college,
because
after college, I told my parents, I was like, hey, I'm going to try to do this comedy. Is it okay? And they were very supportive. So I kind of thought, if I don't pull this off in 2 years, that's it. I'm kind of like, that's it.
Yeah.
So I pushed hard in any place. I never slept. I like did everything I could. So stand-up was one of the things, because I saw so many of my heroes do it. Came in with a bunch of jokes and did very well that first time. But it's because you have to bring six people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so people were very supportive.
You had your own cheering section.
Yeah. And so, and because the first couple of jokes go well, you get confidence, and then you're able to be more confident with your jokes. And then, you know, so that happened. And then afterwards, they called me back after I did it twice, being like, you can come now and you don't have to bring anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, really? They go, yeah, you've done well enough in these first
that
two.
That means you've graduated to a certain...
Yeah, but I'm not like anything. I'm still on like a open mic show. Yeah. I'm still a crappy show. It's just like... And so I waited. I was by myself. I just got out of work. I was a page at Letterman. I had like my backpack on me, and I was looking at these jokes and waiting so long for other people to finish their stuff and watching people judge each other. And I was like, okay, and got on stage and just, I bombed.
Yeah.
Like hard bomb. Like my soul hurt bombed. I like apologized to the crowd when I was on stage. And I walked off, and I was doing improv at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And when you fail in improv, you kind of fail together and you kind of learn with that.
Yeah.
But when I failed by myself, man, you were all alone. In stand-up, when you fail, you are all alone. And then I was like kind of splitting my time between the two. And I realized that if I'm really going to keep taking class in improv and stuff, I probably should just keep concentrating on that. So I did improv and sketch instead of sticking with stand-up. But I had this freelance job for Letterman jokes and for Weekend Update, so I kept writing jokes always.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the combination of doing improv and writing jokes for other people is what helped me become a better writer.
Yeah, but the UCB thing, I mean, that's a big part of this is you got in there at the right time, right?
I mean, I think that's probably right. Right. It was before, there's a lot of people in it now. And it was like, I was there when like, ASCAT, there's a show called ASCAT, you know, but just in case the listeners, like in New York, it was Amy Poehler, Matt Walsh, Matt Besser, Ian Roberts were the UCB four. Then Horatio would perform. Then Tina Fey would come by. Rachel Dratch would come by. Like, it's crazy. Alec Baldwin would do monologues. Mike Myers did monologues. It's just, and then like the other people who now become famous are Jack McBrayer, Paul Scheer, Rob Hubel, Rob Riggle, Rob Corgi was doing stuff then. And it's just the funniest people you've ever seen in your life. And they're all just underground this Gristiti's, this grocery store. So it felt like a magic moment. And then I think because of that, because we had these incredible teachers, the generation of my generation, the generation after me and so on is just stacked. It's like Ellie Kemper was Bobby Moynihan. Mm-hmm. They're all these incredible people, Adam Pally, Gil Lazeri. Thomas Middleditch. So it was a very special time to be in that theater, and it was still like people were doing crazy shows. We did crazy shows and just tried anything. And it was a great place to get your voice. I'm assuming it still is, but it was it is like the birthplace of me becoming a comedian.
Yeah, and it became this sort of breeding ground for all these shows. Well, I mean SNL, but also all these other shows and you know Parks and Rec, which you obviously ended up on.
Yeah, there's a lot of UCB people in Parks and Rec.
So how did you get jokes on SNL?
So I was doing it. So I was a page for Letterman. This crazy story of how, because I didn't know anybody that did this. So I got to be a page at Letterman. And then there's a guy named Greg Volk who was a page with me. And he was freelancing jokes. And he was kind enough to, I was there for like a year and change. And he gave me the guy's email, Steve Young, who was the guy who did the jokes there. And he said, you know, you can email him. And I emailed Steve and he said, you know, we're not looking for anybody right now. I said, okay. I go, he goes, but check back in with me. And I go, okay. And then I check back in with him like a month or two before or whatever it was, a couple months before it was supposed to end.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm kind of leaving. He goes, okay, you can submit three jokes and that's it. And I was writing these big chunky jokes like I was doing stand-up.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when you watch the show and I watched it for so long, Steve was like, it's a punch-up. It's a setup and a punch-up. A setup and a joke. That's it.
Yeah.
Letterman doesn't do that. Weekend Update, when I wrote for Weekend Update.
You can do longer bits.
Yeah. So I was, because, you know, he does a lot. And so you realize that. You learn how to write for that particular person. And then I did it for Letterman, and I was performing at UCB enough where I became friends with Horatio, because I was an intern during ASCAT.
Horatio Sanz, yeah.
Yep. And then Horatio Sanz was like... you know, they freelance for Weekend Update too. Do you want to do that? And I was like, you only get paid if you get a joke on. So it doesn't cost them anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, that's so kind. So I did it for Weekend Update.
So who was the anchor when you were doing it?
When I got a joke on, Tina had a baby. So it was Amy and Horatio.
Oh, yeah.
So Horatio
his
subbed
short,
in
his
for
short-lived
Tina.
Stint yeah,
he did. He
Weekend
did like
Update
two or
anchor.
Three or something like that. And he was...
Is he the one who delivered your
he
jokes?
He delivered both of my jokes.
What was? Do you remember what those were?
One of them was a little inappropriate, probably. The other
that's
one,
okay.
Oh, well, one of them was... the one that I loved the reaction to was... Fuck, I'm trying to remember. It was a very long time ago. There's a new report. There's a new study that shows. There's a new study that shows that if you have a clown inside the hospital room, it raises morale and really does mm-hmm. make someone feel better, mm-hmm. proving that laughter is in fact the best medicine. Unless you have cancer, then you should get chemo. And the laugh was, oh,
yeah.
And then everybody laughed, and it was for someone at UCB also like to get one on. That's kind of a fucked up joke.
Yeah.
It was like a huge win. And also to hear the audience be like, are we allowed to laugh? Yes, yeah. we are. And everybody went crazy. It was a huge moment for me. So I got that joke on. And then we were in Idaho because my sister married a gentleman from Idaho. And we were there for something. And I jumped up and down in the hotel room bed. And I hit the power button of the controller and it shut off the TV.
Oh, no.
And I grabbed the controller and I popped it back on. And it went to like the hotel screen, which
yeah.
is like, you know,
yeah,
what do you
start
want?
Start over, yeah.
It was terrible. And I got it back on right as they were delivering my second joke.
Okay.
So I got two on the same exact joke.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was crazy.
Yeah.
That was a huge moment. And my parents were in the adjoining room. And they heard me yelling, and I go, okay, joke, you know, because I never got a joke on SNL, and that's like the biggest bucket list thing for me has always yeah. been trying to host SNL. Yeah. So,
what about being on SNL? Was that a dream of yours? Did you ever audition or anything?
No, I never. I think I sent in like a series of my videos, mm-hmm. but I never got to audition yeah. or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think they
now
were,
you've moved on to hosting. Now you're
I hope one day I get to host or do something. That's like at
that
the very
be
beginning.
Cool.
I set myself three bucket list things.
Mm-hmm.
One was to be a voice in The Simpsons because that like shaped my life. One was to be a guest on Letterman, which I got to do. And then the last one was, and these are like, you know,
yeah.
dream of all dreams. Not in my head, it doesn't seem like
yeah.
it's there. Maybe one day, but
yeah.
it's not like, oh my God, I'm going to do this. It's like, this would be the biggest, this would be like, if I get it, I'm afraid I'm just going to cry when I get
yeah.
the whole time.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I've been working nonstop for so long and that would be the ultimate, like, you did it type
yeah.
thing. But who
yeah.
knows?
And then everything will be great and you'll feel
oh yeah
perfect.
That's
yeah.
what it is,
solves
right?
all your problems
once you
right?
get either money or SNL everything changes and your life is better. And that's what I heard.
Coming up, Ben explains how close he came to missing out on the role that transformed his career. Yes, I'm talking about Jean Ralphio on Parks and Recreation. So the other thing that I know was a big sort of part of your coming up in comedy is the whole Comedy Bang Bang world.
Oh, yeah.
So I wrote this oral history of Comedy Bang Bang a few years ago.
Did you interview me?
Yeah, so very briefly, yeah, for that.
Oh,
I interviewed
amazing.
Like 40 people who'd been on the show.
That's great.
And I'm just such a big fan of that podcast. And,
I mean, I'm doing it tomorrow.
Yeah.
I shouldn't spoil it. When does this come out?
In a week or two.
I'm
yeah,
giving
week,
you the fucking,
so, yeah.
I'm giving you the juicy
yeah.
goose.
What's
tomorrow's
the
a solo bolo,
solo
baby.
Solo bolo back.
We're bringing it back. I kept asking Scott when we're going to do another one, and he's like, sometime. And he didn't really,
yeah.
I was like, and now he's like, oh, this is the perfect time, because
yeah.
Sonic and everything. I was
yeah.
like, great. So we're doing solo bolo, I guess it would be called Se Solo.
Yeah, this
but I'm
is
very
the
excited.
Sixth one.
Yeah. yeah, this will be the sixth.
Wow.
Yes, yeah, this will be the sixth one. But I love doing it. I love doing it as myself. One, because I get to push Scott to be the crazy person a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So, because when you have crazy people, he's usually the one that has
yeah,
to keep everybody
has
under
to
control.
Be a straight man. And,
yeah, but I get to kind of play with him, and especially on those solo bolo things,
mm-hmm.
I push him as hard as I can. Because it's just like two friends hanging out and singing. Two nerdy friends who like musicals and music hanging
yeah.
out. And
you guys sing a lot, which is fun. Yeah.
I love it so much. And I've learned that it's very divisive in the community where people are like, ugh, fucking two little idiots singing? I don't know. Or other people are like, this is my favorite version
yeah.
of what this could be. I love it.
Yeah.
But I love that you did that because it is a very, if you think about the people that have come through
it's
Comedy
unbelievable.
Bang, it is unbelievable. And people will come up to me on the street and not from Parks or Sonic
mm-hmm.
or anything. They'll be like, oh my God, I'm mm-hmm. a huge Comedy Bang Bang fan. I love that. He's created something pretty remarkable.
Yeah. But Parks, I think, was the thing that really
mm.
brought you to a whole new audience. And I think it's still, I would imagine, what most people come up to you about
yeah.
or recognize
that
you
from. That is definitely the most. And then it's like House of Lies. And
yeah.
then it's cartoons.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? But yeah, Parks is, it's funny because Parks wasn't big when it was out. And then near the end of its run, it started to get more popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of every season, I remember Mike was like, oh, we have no idea if we're getting picked up again.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was never
yeah.
really big. And then Netflix has made it a bigger
yeah.
deal.
Now it's more popular than it ever was.
It's like kids.
Before.
Kids
yeah.
will come up to me. Like
mm-hmm.
kids that you wouldn't even think, like 14-year-old kids.
So what's the story behind how you got that and how the
yeah,
origins
so,
of Jean Ralphio?
Sure. So I met with Katie Dippold, who's an Upright Citizens Brigade person,
mm-hmm.
also has written for Paul Feig, and I've written a series of movies She's just a brilliant writer and an incredible improviser. I do a show at Largo called Ben Schwartz and Friends, where I invite my friends, and she's in almost every single one whenever she's available. So she, I guess, was writing an episode, or maybe I had a meeting with her, Mike Schur, about possibly being in the show. What I learned later was it was for the role that it was Amy Poehler's boyfriend, who was the cop.
Mm-hmm.
That was, it was around that time, and so they're meeting me for that.
That ended up being Louis C.K.
That was Louis C.K. And then
that's because, funny that you were up for that same role.
Well, then I literally, when they met me, or when Mike met me, he was like, "Yeah, I think you're too old, or you're too young for this role." But he saw me in, I did these shorts for ESPN, like Sunday Conversations. It's like a thing where an interviewer interviews like an athlete in a serious way.
Mm-hmm.
But I did them in a really fucked up, weird way, or like really unprepared.
Yeah.
A long time ago, like a long time ago. And I guess you could say they're like a version of like what Zach does in Between Two Ferns, which I think is the funniest thing in the world.
Yeah.
Back then I was doing with an athlete, but not nearly as good as Zach. But like, you know, like I was a crazy, like whatever.
Unprepared interviewer. Or
anything would tangent me and I would just talk about crazy shit. And he saw those and I'm in a shirt, I'm in a suit and I'm kind of acting a little bit douchey sometimes and then sometimes really excited and sometimes, and he goes up to me and he goes, "I saw these, I thought you're," because he's a big sports guy. Really liked you in these. He goes, I want you to know, just because this may not be for, this role might not be for you because you're a little bit too young for it. This show is like The Simpsons. There's going to be characters, you know, all over the place that make up the town. So if something comes up, we'll think of you. And I said, great. And then I got the story of me getting John Ralphio is actually weird, but I guess someone from Parks had emailed my agent's assistant at the time, and my agent's assistant passed without telling me about it. I have no idea what happened. All I know is that Katie then emailed me and goes, "Oh, we're bummed that you're not going to do it."
Oh,
I go, "What are you talking about?" She goes, "That you're not going to do Parks." I go, "Whatever it is, what is it? I don't even know what it is. I'll do it. I don't even care what it is. I love the show. I'll do anything you want." She goes, "Oh, we heard that you may be passing." I go, "What are you talking about?
That's
whatever
insane.
It is, I'm in."
Yeah.
I said, "Okay." And then I don't know if it was someone subbing in the desk and by mistake. I don't know what happened.
It was just like a
I don't know what happened, but I know that someone by mistake had almost passed on it.
Oh my God. Can you imagine if she hadn't called you?
It would have been crazy. And for real. Maybe they said, or maybe it was taking a while for me to get back, and the person just forgot to forward me that email.
Yeah.
But because everybody at that place, all the assistants have been so on it. I bet it was someone subbing for someone and just got lost or whatever. But so they said, they sent it to me. It's just a paragraph. They go, "It's just a paragraph, but there's a chance there could be more. You know, there's a chance you could be like Aziz's good friend in it." And I said, "Okay, all right, great."
And this is the scene where you come in as Ron Swanson's assistant?
Yeah, to interview for Ron Swanson. And I was a little bit nervous.
It's just one scene in that first episode,
that's
right?
That's the whole. That's my whole character. That was my whole character.
"Ronald, I've done it. I found your assistant, and he's dope. His name is Jean Ralphio. Jean Ralphio!"
"Big T. What's Mr. up? Swanson, two things. One, it is an absolute honor to meet you. Two, who is that hot intern chick out there? Because honestly, damn!"
Take a seat.
Right,
here we go. "So, Jean Ralphio."
"You got him right here. Leave a message after the beat."
"Why do I want you as my assistant?"
"For starters, access to the illest clubs. And that's just for starters. I will work for you. I will be on you 24/7. I'll be like your family. I'm here when you get here in the morning. Sure enough, I'll be there tucking you into bed at night. Don't worry, it's not gay. Do we have questions?"
"I think our only question is, when can you start?"
"Right now, let's do it."
"Thank you for coming in. We will talk."
"Cool, I feel good about this. And you know, you can hit me up on Facebook anytime, day or night. You know that, right?"
"Take care, buddy."
Boom.
And you thought that was gonna be it?
I thought there's a chance that you can come back, but this is it right now. Said, okay, Mike Schur comes down, which made me a little bit more nervous because the guy who created the show and the guy who wrote on The Comeback and the guy who helped with The Office.
Legend.
And he's a genius was there, and I was like, okay. And so I did it, and I did it pretty well, and he came up to me afterwards and he goes, "You'll be coming back." And he went upstairs, I think, to continue writing whatever episode I was going to be because there must have been a chance like, oh, if he's pretty good, this would be good for whatever. And I did it, and then because he said that, I felt more comfortable when they were, because that was just a rehearsal. When we were recording, I felt
Yeah.
Way more comfortable.
More freedom.
And even more,
to go
it's
for
like
it.
That thing in improv when you get your first laugh, you get that confidence to really go after risks you want to take, especially at the beginning. So, like, when I got that laugh from Mike, or then, you know what I mean? Then I really, whatever. And so that's how it started. And then I kept coming back and I became more and more of a cartoon.
Yeah.
It was my favorite. The words were always the funniest words. That writing staff is one of the best writing staffs of all time.
Not a lot of improv for you on that show?
I improvised a lot.
Yeah.
But always did the script as is. And then afterwards, we did something called a fun run.
Yeah.
Where they had something called a party bag or a something bag where they had like alts that you could try that they had written. And then they let you do whatever you want. And a bunch of my anything you want things went because that character kind of lended itself to be a little bit looser and crazier. But the words by themselves were always incredible.
Yeah, and
always the funniest scripts.
And the Jean Ralphio universe kind of expanded with Jenny Slade and
The
Henry
GRU.
Winkler.
Yeah, you're talking about the MCU and the GRU, the Jean Ralphio universe, the Jean Ralphio cinematic universe. Then that character grew out to be have a sister, and Henry Winkler is my father.
That must have been pretty great working with Henry Winkler.
Oh, it was incredible. When he told me who was going to play my father, I was so excited.
Yeah.
And he was so nice. I remember the day that we were recording our first scene, I hurt my back or something like that, and Henry like helped crack out my back. And I was like, you're a magician. You're incredible. First day I met him.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
What was the effect of that? Obviously, on your fans come up to you a lot for it, but what was the effect of Parks and Rec and that character on your career in terms of opportunities?
Yeah, well, now there's a thing that I could point to, or not even that. Now there's a thing that people knew before I came in the room, which is helpful. Mm-hmm. So they know that, you can do that. I've seen you do this.
Yeah.
So if it's something that's in the comedic world, they knew maybe I could handle it. Or if it's in dramatic, like, we know you can do this, can you do this?
Mm-hmm.
But it was a thing to point to, which is still a thing. It's funny because so many years later and I've done like so many things, and that is still the thing that people are like, oh, that's the character that I love, that me and my kids watch this every night. And so it's been very cool, but it gave me like just people recognized me as a comedian and actor a little bit more. So if they saw me do improv, they're like, well, can he act? And then they see me that, like, oh, we like the way he acts here. So it opened up some doors. But you know, it's recurring. It's not, I wasn't a lead character.
Yeah.
That character has somehow become very popular, but I was only in 21 episodes out of 150 or something.
Very memorable though.
Yeah. I don't know. I lucked out. People really like the way I play him. I always want to make him endearing, that you cared about him because he was just going to screw up every episode.
Yeah.
So if you look like he always thought he was nailing it and he never meant to hurt anybody.
Yeah.
Then you kind of,
he wasn't
like,
just a pure jerk.
Yeah. Either. I want you to care. I want you to like him while he's being an idiot. Yep. So, but that helped me quite a bit, because then people would see me, and so auditions that I may not have been get on before, now they'll see me in Parks and be like, "Oh, we like him. Maybe let him audition." Something.
Yeah.
But it never became like, "Let's offer him a role because of this." It was always like, "All right, well, now we'll let him in the room and see what he can do."
What was sort of the next big thing after that that you landed that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise?
House of Lies was very big because it was more dramatic.
Yeah.
But then getting big movies, like, it mattered. Like, This Is Where I Leave You was a movie I did,
because
I've done like 12 independent films. But doing that, there's different things. Like, for my writing, selling my first book was big because it helped. I've published four now. But selling my first movie was huge.
Yeah.
Selling your first screenplay is a big deal, because first it gets you in the WGA, but also it shows that you can do this. And then people can look at that screenplay and hire you. So selling that first one led to me selling, you know, four more and punching up countless scripts and stuff like that. So the writing stuff, that first one was a very big one. Selling that, because it's very hard to sell your first one. So that was big. And then getting my first cartoon show was huge. So like all these little things helped within the world. So getting your first studio movie was big, because then all of a sudden people think about you for studio stuff. Writing a feature, that was big. And then I got on the Blacklist. That was a very big thing.
Oh, yeah.
I wrote a movie called El Fuego Caliente, which is a telenovela version of Soap Dish from the 90s. And it got on the Blacklist.
Which is the list of, can explain it for anyone who doesn't know, but it's the list of unpublished screenplays every year that comes out that sort of ranked as the top screenplays that haven't been made yet.
Right. It's a testament to a gentleman named Franklin Leonard, who started it from nothing. And I believe had he would be better at talking about it than I, but I'll do a terrible job. But he had a series of assistants and people that read scripts all the time, read all these scripts and vote on them. And then he gave the ability to have people like me, who maybe sold a movie but nobody really read it before, to like really amplify the idea of like, oh, this person wrote a good script, check it out.
Yeah.
So that was my second script I ever wrote, and so, or sold. not wrote, I've written before, but Sanctuary of a Soul, because then now people can see that I was on Blacklist, read that script, and all of a sudden I had a little bit more room to pitch my own ideas and really push them out.
I'm fascinated by the world of Punch-Up, too, because it's kind thing that people don't really talk about, or I don't know if you're not
so
supposed
weird.
To talk about it.
I don't even know if
it,
we're allowed to. So I've done so many roundtables.
Yeah.
I've done so many roundtables, but you get paid very little. I'm assuming you could talk about it.
You would know more than I would.
Right. You get paid very little money unless you're like one of the big ones.
To kind of add jokes to existing scripts, right?
So what would happen is that there'd be like a movie is in the writing phase and it's... It's smart. You get a bunch of fun writers around a room. You read the script out loud, and then people work on, or you'll say your pitches with jokes. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes when they hired me, it's either for jokes or just to see the structure of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go in, you give notes, but you're around, like, I've been around tables where, like, Judd Apatow is there. And so, why am I here? Like, he's a genius.
Yeah.
I remember even saying that. There was a round table, and it's in all movies do this, because the idea is, why not make it's not like illegal, it's like you're hiring us to, anybody who wants to can say yes, and you get paid a little bit of money, and you punch up anything you want.
Seems like a fun thing to do.
It is fun, although after you do it for a while, you're like, oh, I'm giving away so many jokes that I can be using my own things. But, you know, if there's a script that, I remember they had just done a table read of a script, and then all the actors left, and then the writers were around. And Apatow was not next to me, but he was, in the room somewhere. And it was for, I forget for what movie, but so then they go, okay. And they go, thoughts, anybody? And nobody says anything because, you don't want to be first. And they go, Schwartz, what do you think? I go, you're asking me first? Judd Apatow is here. You're not going to ask me first. You got to ask Judd Apatow first. But I did that for a lot of things, punched up a lot of different movies. And then started doing, after the movies were made, I started getting hired. Again, I'm sure there are people that get paid a lot of money for this, but I've always been the one that does not. Maybe, I don't know, maybe now that I'm saying no a bit more, it'll change. But I would be called in for movies that are done that needed to be funnier, the shot. So I would be, do you have any ideas for ADR? So ADR is after the movie's done that someone can come with a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either over their shoulder where you can't see the joke, or if it's an animated CG character, I could help that quite a bit because you can do jokes later on.
That's like in a movie where someone's, walking away and then there's like one more joke thrown in.
We need a beat here. While he's walking away or in this wide shot, you can't see, is there something that can punch this up or something that'll make, so I did that.
Sometimes those are more obvious than others.
But, but the fun thing is when I did that, I could see a movie before anybody else, which I'm a nerd for movies. So I'm like, this is exciting.
Was there anyone that stands out that you got to see before anyone else that you were like, oh, this is going to be
well, not for big? ADR, but for BB-8 stuff, I was the first person outside of editors to see A Force Awakens.
Yeah, which was pretty big.
It was huge. I have a video of myself sitting down before they pressed play. I was so excited. I was going bananas.
Yeah.
I'm a big Star Wars fan, but now that I've been doing a little bit of stuff with them, I know that I'm not there's real fans. Yeah. So I'm a fan because I love the films, but there are people who really done their research.
I did hear that you got some jokes into
A perfect ADR example is for C-3PO.
Yeah.
The movie was done, but there are segments that JJ is like, oh, can we punch up C-3PO a little bit? So I got like four or five jokes in that, but that's the biggest one. I mean,
For the super fans, what were the, do you remember any of the jokes that
you can... Yeah, I wrote them down. I also, the way that we did them, me and... Stefan Grube, who edited it, was one of the two editors on not Force Awakens, but Rise of Skywalker, which is 9. I would be in the editor room with him, and I'd watch pieces of the movie. Mm-hmm. I'd write down my jokes, and then I'd go to him, and I'd record them as voice notes so he could plug them in so JJ could see kind of where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And if JJ liked it, he'd get Anthony Daniels
to do it. Were you doing a C-3PO voice?
Yes.
Or no?
Yeah. I did. I don't know. Like that stuff. So I have all these voice notes on my phone there. But one was, my favorite one was when they fall down the sand pits. Oscar Isaac's character is going around and is like, Finn, are you okay? Or Finn, are you okay? Ray, are you okay? And then C-3PO in the shot. So again, remember, all I see is the shot, like he doesn't, he's not saying anything.
Yeah.
So I see C-3PO is coming out there, and C-3PO is the easiest to make voiceover for because his mouth doesn't move.
Yeah, perfect.
So it's easy. So I had him come up, you okay? And then C-3PO comes in and goes, you didn't say my name, but I'm okay. Because it was just perfect. He was walking in out of the background. Yeah.
That's great.
But then a couple more. But it was heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, and the fact that JJ let me be any part of any of those is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I do want to touch on Sonic, even though I know you've probably
you've
talked about it
quite
a lot.
A different way.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it a different way. I was a big Sonic fan growing up of the game. I was a Sega. I was a Sega kid, not a Nintendo kid. So
were you a Kid Chameleon boy, or what were you, an Altered Beast boy? Were you a Quackshot boy?
Like original Sonic.
NHL Sonic.
Sonic. I also liked Toe Jam and Earl.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Of course. Were you Earthworm Jim Man or no?
No, not that
Earthworm
one as
Jim
much.
Jim is about a worm
that
has a superhero type body and
that
a gun.
I wasn't big on. NBA Jam was also huge. Yeah, I'm sure you were a big NBA Jam fan.
I had a Super Nintendo. David Fernandez had Genesis, so I'd go to his house play Genesis. But Super Nintendo for me was Street Fighter, NBA Live, NBA Jam, Final Fantasy 2 and 3, Super Mario World. I was in love with that system. Yeah.
So how did you end up being the voice of Sonic the Hedgehog?
You asked a question that nobody's ever it's a cool story. It started with Tim Miller, who directed Deadpool. He goes, I want to have a meeting with you about a different project. He was doing something else, and he had a meeting with me, and he was very cool. And then I saw all these Sonic dolls on Jeff Fowler's desk, and he's like, oh yeah, we're going to try to make a 5-minute video to try to sell Sonic to different studios, because we're trying to give it to a studio. And I was like, oh, man. And they knew I did voiceover work. And I was like, well, if you ever need me, he goes, yeah, we do. We need somebody to do the test. You would be amazing. But I got to tell you, it doesn't mean you're going to be the guy for the movie. You'd just be doing it for this. It's a favor for us. Jeff Fowler was great. First day I met him, he was a nerd. Great. Not nerd. You know, he's a brilliant man. But him and I have those nerdy sensibilities where we really cared about Sonic. We cared about video games. We cared about sneakers. We cared about cartoons. He's just a fucking great guy, Jeff. And so I said, okay, let's do it. I got paid, you know, close to nothing. Went in the room. Jeff shot 5 minutes of footage with Reed Scott, was the gentleman in the test from Veep.
Yeah.
And they're going to include this in either the Blu-ray or the DVD, which is cool. And then we did what my lines were, but Jeff is like, improvise like crazy. Do whatever you want. We just want this to be as funny as possible. We're trying to sell this. So the best joke, best everything wins. So I improvised a shit ton. Even sang a little bit in it. And like did like crazy stuff in it. And then they put it together and they made him, even back then, Sonic was so cute. In the test, it was like this cute little thing. It was great. And they sold it to Paramount. And then I asked my agents. I was like, oh, they sold it. What do we think? They go, it doesn't mean you're going to be the guy. Yeah. I was like, oh. And it was like months of me waiting to find out, because I'm sure, you know, Paramount has their thing. And of course, why wouldn't you go with a big celebrity or something like that? And I think during their search, or as they were figuring it out, they kept going to that test. And they kept loving the way that I played them. And so anytime they were talking about someone or they heard someone, I was told that they just loved my thing. So Neil Moritz, who did all the Fast and the Furious, Toby Asher as a producer, Jeff, and then eventually Paramount was like, Ben should do it.
We already got the guy.
So it's one of those things where doing a favor actually paid off.
Yeah.
And then, so I said yes, and that was it.
It must have been a shitload of work.
It was so much more than I thought it was going to be, because I've done a lot of voiceover
writing. Yeah, this is like, voiceover
I've done
plus.
Hundreds of episodes of television, hundreds, because I love cartoons.
Yeah.
We did, first of all, they also, they had me for 6-hour records for if you've ever done voiceover.
Didn't they like
before.
Capture your face movements?
They captured my face. I did table reads. I punched up once. We did one of those round tables. But like in terms of voiceover stuff, I went there. I did a table read. Then I went there and I recorded all my lines into a microphone so Jeff had them, how I would be delivering them so James could also see them. Then I did them with James. Then James and I became friends and talked a little bit. And then when they came back, we did so many records. A, because I wanted to make sure it was the best. I would be like, hey, can I listen to what we did yesterday and see if I can make it better?
Yeah.
So I would do that every now and then with Jeff, and he doesn't have to let me do that. And he would. He'd let me see pieces of the movie just so I can see if I can think of better jokes. And the script is fucking great. The script works. It's a good movie. I'm really excited. Yeah. By now, the movie's come out, so you'll see if people care. But I'm really proud of it. I thought it went really well, and I think I'm happy with the way that Sonic looks and it sounds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also, Jim Carrey is so fucking
good. I was going to ask you about Jim Carrey.
He's amazing.
Have you gotten to hang with him
much?
I
never met him during shooting. I met him one day during shooting and immediately asked him about Ace Ventura, like a little stupid idiot. And then afterwards during press, now I've been to London with him, stuff like that, and been able to spend a little bit of time with him. And he's so lovely and connects with you. He's not on his phone. He looks you in the eyes. Yeah. He asks you a question. And he's a hero of mine. So
can imagine.
It's bananas for me that there's like, I'll show you these pictures. I'm allowed to post. By the time this comes out, so we took pictures, we did Kelly Clarkson together, him and James, And afterwards, I like, you know, you put on makeup for these things, mm-hmm. and I take off the makeup, and someone came up to me, they go, hey, Jim's doing a photo shoot downstairs, do you want to do it with him? And I was like, Vroot! And I yeah. like went, to, and the guy's like, okay, so we're just going to do like this photo shoot, it's like a, just like pretend it's like a class photo, and we took like a series of pictures, maybe six pictures, some of that,
mm-hmm.
and they are like the best, I cannot believe I'm in pictures with Jim Carrey, and he's doing Jim Carrey things,
yeah,
and I'm not allowed to post them until like a couple more days from
oh,
now.
Really?
So people will know now if they listen to this and they go on my Instagram or whatever.
Yeah.
It's these pictures are just like, that was, I saw those and I, because I saw the screen afterwards and I went up to him, I go to the photographer, listen to me, please. And he goes, yeah. I go, I don't care about anything in my life right now except for these pictures. Can you find a way to please
yeah,
send me these pictures? They're so, they're yeah. just like, I can't believe I'm in a picture yeah. with Jim like this. And so it was at like the beginning of our press stuff too. So yeah. I just really didn't know him.
Yeah.
And so I have those pictures now and I'm going to post them.
Yeah, we'll share them on our Instagram
yeah,
at awesome. Last Laugh Pod too.
Great.
Check it out.
Do it.
Up next on The Last Laugh, we look back at some more of my favorite moments from Ben's career, including the story behind one of the funniest bits to ever air on the Oscars. So what I want to do now is usually the last segment of the show is going through some of the stuff that you've done that we didn't get to talk about.
Okay.
I have a very long list for you, so it's probably going to take a little
oh,
longer.
Oh, that's great. That makes me feel...
Because you've done a lot of amazing stuff.
You're very kind.
I saw that your first TV appearance was on Conan.
Oh, yeah, it was.
You,
that's
can,
true.
What can you tell us about that?
It's a great one. So some people at UCB every now and then will get pulled. I believe her name was Cecilia. I forget who it was, but there's a person who would cast UCB people as like side roles in the sketches for Conan. So I got selected two times or three times. One was to play a robot because I just was 6 feet tall and I could fit in a robot suit. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any lines. I would just move. I was so nervous. And it didn't even air. The other one was me and Gil Ozeri, who ended up being in Hot Sauce with me and mm-hmm. one of the funniest people in the world, were like pages for a political person who had done something bad to pages. I forget the sketch, unfortunately. But, we were in like a dream sequence. We were pretending to be flying.
Yeah.
So they cast us and we got to do that. And that was insane. Mm-hmm. It was crazy because Conan was, for me, it was Letterman. Letterman was like my dad's generation, the person I looked up to. Conan was like the cool dude. He was like the cool guy that we all watched.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because he's on a little bit later. So you watch Letterman. Then I watch Letterman with my parents. And when they think I'm going to sleep, I'd watch Conan.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a thrill to do that. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
An early movie role was in The Other Guys. Mm-hmm. With Adam McKay directing.
Yeah, there's a good story in that. You're picking great ones.
Yeah. What's the story with that?
So Allison Jones cast that, who's, I think, one of the best casting directors in the world. She's cast The Office, Parks and Rec. She's cast Arrested Development. She's cast all the comedic Adam McKay movies, Judd Apatow movies.
Yeah, everything.
She's a genius.
Freaks and Geeks, I feel, is her
Freaks and Geeks.
Like, thing that is legendary.
It's incredible.
Every single person she discovered.
And she's so funny. I wish she would write because she's so funny, but so she, I wrote when I was writing jokes for Letterman, one of my jokes got into Time Out New York as joke of the week.
Mm-hmm.
She in LA somehow got a subscription to Time Out New York and saw the joke and next to the joke was my face.
Mm-hmm.
And she called to see if I had an agent, but I didn't have any real agents, so I was a commercial agent. I got a hold of my commercial agent and said, hey, does Ben never come to LA? And I, of course, had never. But randomly that week, which is a Starburns tie-in a little bit too, I had a meeting about writing for Robot Chicken.
Okay.
So the first time ever I was going to go to L.A. I was mm-hmm. always afraid to go to L.A. And so she called randomly when the next week I was going to go to L.A. So I go there, I meet her. She's the best. Like, we connect so hard because I'm a nerd for all the stuff she's done.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day she's like, do you want to audition for Semi-Pro? I was like, with Will Ferrell? Yeah, of course I do.
Okay.
So I do it, and I'm not right for the role, and it's my first time ever auditioning for that big
thing. She
was
like, you're tall, baby.
Yeah, you can fit in this robot suit. So I did that, and I didn't get it, but she then thought of me for stuff. So mm-hmm. then she cast me my first pilot called Happiness Isn't Everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got that role, I thought my life had changed. I thought, like, once you get a TV show, that's it. That's it. Now you get to do anything.
Yeah.
Was not the case. Did not go. The show did not go. It was me, Richard Dreyfuss, Mary Steenburgen, Jason Biggs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Directed by Jim Burrows.
Yeah.
And that's written
a big
by
deal.
Mitch Hurwitz.
Oh, my God.
Yep. And Jim Valley. So it was insane. That didn't go. But we became very, very close. We became friends. And mm-hmm. it was like great. And she was very supportive of me. Although I've only been cast in three things of her in my 15-year career.
What were the three?
Happiness Isn't Everything, The Other Guys, and this new one, Space Force, that I'm in now with John
Malkovich. We're going to get to that. Yeah.
Okay, so what she would do is she knew that I was writing movies, and I just moved here. I had no money. I was renting a Toyota Corolla, I was sleeping on my friend's couch. I was sleeping in a tent inside of Chad Carter and Will McLaughlin's apartment.
Why in a tent?
Because I was sleeping in my boxers on a blow-up mattress, and Chad's girlfriend at the time was like, maybe you should put on some whatever. I said, sure. So we put a. So he goes, I got a tent. So it was like very beginning days for me. She goes, if you want a place to write, you can always write. There's room in the office in her like smaller office at Gower.
That's nice.
So I would write there, and like it would be great because I got along really well with Peter Koussakis, who was there, and Ben Harris, who's a casting associate now and also casting his own stuff, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And so we became friends, and every now and then she asked me if I could do her a favor. And one of them would be, can you come for this role, I'm not considered for the role, mm-hmm. but would you come in and be the person that reads with these people? Because I want you to improvise with them.
Yeah.
I want to see if they can handle improv. So one of those was for Adam McKay, mm-hmm. And who I had become closer with afterwards because me and him were in Shanling's basketball league.
Oh, yeah.
Basketball league and just the game he played. And so my thing for the other guys was for the bigger roles, I would audition with people and I would try to push them away from the script. Mm-hmm. And Adam would tell him, hey, Ben will kind of take you away and back, you know, play if you can. And Adam could see what people could do. And Adam loved when I fucked with everybody mm-hmm. and like went away and came back.
Who were some of the people that you read with?
Shit, I don't even remember. I remember being nervous for a couple of them. John Leguizamo was there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I forget who else. There's a lot. We did like a full 2 days of the callbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And some women as well. I auditioned for a lot of the women role. I forget a lot. I wish I knew. By the way, I should ask Allison because I bet now they're all like the most famous people in the world.
Yeah, right.
But afterwards, so that was it. And mm-hmm. then there's this very small role that had like a couple lines and, you know, they're going to cast somebody. Yeah. And then I think Allison must have recommended to Adam. Mm-hmm. What about Ben? And Adam loved the way I was playing people. Yeah, let's let Ben do it.
Yeah. He's like, he helped us out a lot. So
he was so nice. So that was that. And then after that, after I became friends with Adam through basketball and that, then I sold a movie with his studio and I sold a TV show with his studio. So that turned out to be great too. Another favor that worked out. That's another favor I did for free.
And then that's the lesson of this podcast is do favors.
Yeah. Work hard and hopefully something will work out.
You won an Emmy Award for writing Hugh Jackman's opening song at the Oscars 2009.
Another Starburns reference, Dan Harmon.
Oh, yeah. Yep. He worked with you on that.
Yep. Dan Harmon and Rob Schraub, two geniuses. We wrote that musical number for Hugh Jackman, which was crazy.
So, specifically, I have to ask about the part of the most famous part of that song, which is I Haven't Seen the Reader.
The Reader. I haven't seen the Reader. I was going to see it later, but I fell behind. My Batmobile took longer than I thought to design. The Reader. I know I need to see the Reader. I even went down to the theater, but there was a line of all the people watching Iron Man a second time.
It's great.
Is there a story behind that?
Yes, there is. I had a meeting with Hugh Jackman's production company about possibly writing comedic movies for him.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, yeah, we're also producing the Oscars. And I go, oh, my God, if you ever need whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent him my jokes from Letterman SNL. And then I sent, not Hugh, but the production, John, his name was John. And I sent him all my short films. And they were just finding people. Like, I don't know how they found Harmon. I don't know how they found Rob. I have no idea. And we didn't know each other. I never met him before. And they go, okay, you got to go to New York in 2 days. I go, and I just moved here. I had just moved to L.A. And I had these big shows at UCB saying goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And I just moved here. And then like, 5 days later, I go back.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. And on the way there, I'm trying to think of what I would do. And I'm writing these ideas. And I was like, oh, it should be like a recession musical number because we were in a recession right now. And I was like, it should be him like doing it bare bones. And like, you know, because he's a song and dance man. And I didn't know, but Dan Harmon and Rob Schraub had the same exact idea.
Yeah.
So before we met, we had the same idea. So when they came in, like, what do you think? And we talked for a second. We were immediately on the same page.
Yeah.
And man, Schraub is like a genius in like creation and like all these things that he did for, like he created all the backdrops and all the props. And Harmon is just, I remember when I was watching Dan write, I was just like, he's so good. He's so smart. He came up with so much of that. He was so smart. But so we're going through the movies and blah, blah, blah. And I helped out with the, and then John Palermo was his name. John asked, is there any way we can get Anne Hathaway to sing in it? And then I was like, oh, you know what we do at UCB? Me and my friends, like someone will be in the audience and people won't know that they're part of it and be like, get up here, whatever. And it turns into a bit.
Yeah.
So I was like, maybe we do that because we did that a lot with Hot Sauce. And so I wrote this whole thing for her for Frost Nixon, and she sang, and it was great.
Yeah.
It went really well. And then we're going through the movies, and we were trying to pitch lyrics and going back and forth, and then it came The Reader, and I go, all of us, literally all of us said, I go, they're like, what should we do? I go, I didn't read it. Did you? I didn't watch it. Did you? And Rob's like, nope. And Dan's like, nope. I didn't. I go, none of us watched it? Go, no, it's just the one that nobody got to. And so I forget whose idea it was. It probably is either Dan or Rob's. Maybe it was mine. I don't think it was mine. But it was like, then it became a song about how Hugh Jackman's like, I'm so sorry. I didn't see The Reader. There's so much shit. And we really talked about like the idea of like like no superhero movies were nominated, even though like Dark Knight was awesome and all that stuff. But it was great, and it got a great reception. It went over so well. I got invited back to do the next year, but I ended up not doing it. And a different Ben Schwartz did it, which was like a weird thing.
That is weird.
Yeah. But yeah. So there was interest in maybe doing the next year, and then I was like, you know, it was just so good.
Yeah.
I was like, I kind of don't want to. And we won an Emmy for it. Yeah. I was like, oh man,
can't top that.
I was like, that's so crazy. Like, it's so insane that that happened.
Yeah.
Now
the Oscars don't even have hosts.
Isn't that crazy?
I don't like it.
When Chris Rock and Steve Martin did that bit yesterday,
that was fun.
Or when Maya Rudolph and Kristen Wiig, like, they're genius comedian people that could crush it.
Yeah. Well, now they just have like surprise hosts for a monologue, like Chris Rock and Steve Martin.
They were so funny.
Yeah, they were great.
I was on a plane on the way back from New York, and so when I landed, I looked at YouTube clips, and that was one that just blew me away.
Yeah. So I know you just talked about this with Seth Meyers, but the Late Late Show experiments with Adam Pally.
Yeah.
I feel like we just have to touch on that.
Sure. Because this is the forum, I feel like. It was a
legendary thing.
Ferguson had ended. James Corden got hired, but there's weeks. And so the late night or the late, late show staff was like, or the late night, I think it was probably Nick Bernstein. They're like, let's get guest hosts just so we don't have to show reruns. And also the idea of like, we're transitioning from this to this. So to show Ferguson reruns probably up to the end is probably not the way you do it. You find a way to separate it, I guess. I don't know. So Nick Bernstein asked Adam Pally to host one of the nights. And Adam asked if I would be his co-host. And I was going to be in New York because I was doing Letterman.
Yeah.
I was a guest on Letterman. Huge blizzard. Everything was shut down. Pally said that the guests that they wanted, a lot of them couldn't make it. I didn't know any of that. So I got there. I said, there's no, literally zero rehearsal for me. Adam had to learn a lot of shit because he was hosting, you know, whatever. But for me, it was just show up.
Yeah. You didn't know what you were getting into.
And Pally was even like, you shouldn't. Let's just fucking just go. Whatever happens.
Yeah.
So we treated it like a goddamn hot sauce show. Like we just fooled around the whole time. We were idiots.
And you're in the CBS This Morning studio? Is that
Charlie Rose's studio? No audience.
Yeah.
Right? Imagine a late night talk show with no audience. The crew, the camera crew there wasn't a late night camera crew. Pally kept joking that they hated him. I don't know. I didn't get to see that part. But we just like, it was crazy. We did it. And while it was happening, I was like, what is happening?
Yeah.
This is being aired to like so many people.
It wasn't live, right? Did you think it was going to
No, they edited air? Some stuff out. There's some jokes and stuff they edited out. Because they had to make it shorter. I'm sure we ran way too long.
Yeah.
And when it was over, I was like, God, what the fuck just I literally was like, I have no idea what just happened.
Yeah.
Because I also just came from Letterman, where it's like a very structured, very, like they've been doing it for 100 years.
Yeah.
And then Pally and I are being like, doing this bit about Nick Cage for like 3 full minutes.
I can't wait for you to take that sip. You've been flirting with taking that sip all day. Not yet, though. I don't think it's coming yet. Oh.
It's hot. You know, there's one of my favorite movies, Ben, is this movie called Bangkok Dangerous that Nicolas Cage is in.
It's a real film?
It's a real movie. And Nicolas Cage is in it, and there's like a 5-minute scene where he's out on a date with a deaf girl, and they're eating soup in Thailand. And he tries the soup, and for like 5 minutes, he keeps going like this, like, it's hot. Soup is hot. The soup, it's hot. Steam. The soup is hot.
Yeah. Do it for the full
steam,
5 minutes.
It's like a hot steam. It's too hot to drink.
Commit for the full 5 minutes.
Too hot to drink. And then finally the deaf girl like reaches for the soup and he goes, no. It's too hot.
Oh, man.
it was so fun, and then it went on the air. And I watched it. I was like, oh, it was pretty fun. When it was over, I was like, I don't know what that's going to be.
Yeah.
And then when it got edited together, I was like, oh, it's pretty fun. It's mayhem. It's like, yeah, it's old school UCB.
Mm-hmm.
And then nobody really watched it, but the people who did watch it that night, like on Twitter, people were like, what the fuck? What is this?
Yeah.
What's happening? I was like, oh, that's cool. We have like a thing that five people watched. And then it started to go around, but CBS took it off of everything.
Yeah, it started. People would put it up on YouTube, and then it would get taken down. And
I have no idea why.
They were, yeah, maybe they weren't.
Too weird.
They weren't proud of it.
I have no idea, because Nick Bernstein loves it, the guy who hired us.
Yeah.
And then it went on the internet, and then it has this lore of it keeps getting taken down. Yeah. So someone will talk about it and link, and then the link will die.
Yeah.
And so it becomes this weird, like when you were young and like passed down a VHS. Yeah.
It's like you had to see it when it was on.
And so it's now become a thing that like people talk about, and it makes me so happy because, Adam had to probably work pretty hard on it because he had to host it and think of a bunch of the bits, but in terms of the interview, nothing was planned for me. We did nothing. We just, what he's like, don't even, I go, I don't even need to know anything, right? It'd be funnier that way. He goes, no, let's just fucking go. And he was right.
Yeah, that seems like that's kind of his MO too, with like when he has presented at award shows.
Yeah, he just does whatever the hell he wants. he thrives off of the audience, even burning into him. He likes it.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Middleditch and Schwartz on Netflix at the beginning, but just to go back to that for 1 minute.
Yeah.
Can you sort of talk about what that's going to be? That seems like a big challenge doing long form improv on Netflix.
So Middleditch and Schwartz is me and Thomas Middleditch from Silicon Valley, and Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And what it is, it's long form improv. We get a suggestion at the top. We talk to the audience just at the beginning. We talk to one person that talks. It could be anybody. We say, what are you looking forward to? What are you dreading? Someone says, marriage, or someone says bar mitzvah, or someone says my dad's funeral, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We talk to them a little bit in a real way. They're not saying jokey stuff at us. We get a real conversation. We learn about them a little bit. And then we improvise off of whatever it is. So it could be anything. They could talk about a moment in their lives. They can talk about, it could be anything. So it really opens up, because the idea with the suggestion is, instead of just saying, say a word, we want to get more, because I've learned from a bunch of different shows that I've done that, if you learn about character a little bit more, that's fun to play on stage. So then after about 5 to 7 minutes of talking to this person, although it was way longer, we usually talk to them for a while. And then in the special, we try to edit it down because we didn't want
people
to
because that's not the funny part.
it's funny, but it's like, we don't want people to think that that's the show.
Right.
Because the show doesn't really start till we say, ladies and gentlemen, we present you Middleditch and Schwartz. But we'll play around with the audience first, because that's what you do in the tour shows, to loosen up the audience and show them that, hey, we're going to have fun. Yeah. Then explain what the show is. Then we interview this person. So I think we tried to edit down that stuff so people wouldn't lose interest too quickly and get to see what long form improv really is. And then that's it. Nobody else talks. We basically improvise for an hour straight. It's like, it could be like a play, or it could be like a movie, it could be anything. But we tell a full story and we play every character. Mm-hmm. Some shows have two people in it. Some shows have 20 around the same table. Yeah. And we'll play every single character.
Yeah.
And you never know what it's going to be. And so that's why selling it was very difficult.
Yeah.
Because we pitched everywhere. And Netflix was the one that was kind enough to bite. But they'd be like, well, what is it? And they come to a show and they'd be like, this is great. We love your live shows. But like, you have no idea what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What if it's a real crazy show? That's the joy of it.
Did you tape more of them than we'll end up airing?
We taped four, and I think the plan is to air 3 out of 4.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, they're not perfect shows.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even
say. And no improv show is going to be perfect.
Yeah, but one of them is really fun. There's such different feels, but I think that's kind of exciting. So when anybody sees that, okay, another set of Middleditch and Schwartz special coming out, it could be anything.
Yeah.
And we don't really hide that it's not going to be perfect. There are going to be some points, but there are some shows that worked really well. Like out of the ones we did, it's like, oh, that works well. That's just a good representation of one of our shows. And some that are fucking bananas crazy.
Yeah.
And some that are way slower. And so, like, just put it up there and let people see what improv is. I really hope people, it is coming out I think the first half of this year sometime.
Yeah, cool. The last thing I want to touch on, just because I'm very excited about it, is Space Force, which is Greg Daniels created. And I assume that it's somewhat inspired by Trump's Space Force.
It's inspired by the idea that there's an actual Space Force that exists. Yeah. The craziest thing about this show is that we finished filming already. And then the Space Force, the actual Space Force, will release a picture of their camos. And then Greg Daniels and the crew is like, why don't we just release our camera? And I was like, oh, we're doing this while it's happening in real time. It's I don't know,
it's not after the fact. You got, you kind of got ahead of it. Yeah.
Yeah. We filmed it before they started announcing anything.
Yeah.
So
what's like, what can you share about the show, or what's sort of the idea?
We haven't done a lot of press for
it,
so I'll say the generic stuff. But it's Steve Carell, John Malkovich, me, Tawny Newsome, who's a great improviser, Diana Silvers, who is in Booksmart, great actress. The recurring cast is Jimmy O. Yang from Silicon Valley. Don Lake, who's a genius and been in like all these Christopher Guest movies. He's a Toronto improviser. He's really funny in this. And I think he's going to pop like crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm in it as well, as one of the main cast. And so I wonder what they can say. So Steve Carell plays a guy named General Naird. John Malkovich plays like a scientist. I play the head of the media relations.
Which your name in the show is?
My name in the show is Fuck Tony Scarpaducci.
Which sounds a little bit like Anthony Scaramucci. Is there
any? And in the beginning, it sounds a lot like Fuck Jerry. So it's a lot of stuff going on in there.
Was there any Scaramucci influence on your character development?
I did not do my research on Scaramucci as much because I didn't want to do an impression, but I did it as if it was one of these guys that. I wonder what I can say. But I did it as if one of these guys that like always wanted to be like the head of a social media thing, like really put, like he wanted to be like, or like not even a media thing. He wanted to be like the thing that pushed a brand out and really pushed it and maybe has failed in the past. And now this is his chance to try.
This is his big shot.
But I don't know if that backstory makes sense. Yeah. But it was.
Presumably you last longer than Scaramucci.
How many days? 10 days?
11, 10 or 11, depending on how you look
but
at
it.
Yeah.
I mean, Carell is so funny.
Yeah.
And it's a totally different character than he played in The Office.
It's him reuniting with the creator of The Office. So that's pretty big, fucking deal.
It's so fucking funny. The show is written so well. And John Malkovich crushes in it.
Yeah.
I got to just do ADR for one of the episodes. And he's just, he's such a good actor that whatever situation's in front of him, he plays in a realistic way for his character. And that is always he's so funny. So it was just heaven. It was like watching, like what we said at the beginning, I was just watching pros.
Yeah.
And the scripts are amazing. And the directors, Paul King directed two of them and directed Paddington and directed The Mighty Boosh. And we had like all-star directors.
Yeah.
The show is really funny.
Yeah. I'm really excited for that one.
I can't wait. I have no idea what they're going to look like.
Yeah.
But I think they're shot in a beautiful way. So I'm really excited to see.
That's
but there'll be a time when I can talk more about it, I'm assuming, whenever it comes out.
So we end every episode by asking comedians, who's the person that you've worked with who makes you laugh the hardest? Could be...
Gil Ozeri.
Yeah.
Nobody makes me laugh like Gil Ozeri.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas, when we're performing, is incredible. He's definitely up there, but... I've just known Gil for my whole comedic career. He is the funniest person, and it's just everything.
Mm-hmm.
He's just the funniest person. We have been doing a bit for 2004, for 16 years. One day there's so many bits we've been doing for so long. He's not only an incredible improviser and incredible writer, but he's just a funny human. But there's this bit, there's a talking parrot named Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, that was
famous parrot. I remember this.
Do you for real?
Yeah,
and he died.
Yeah,
and I forget when he died. And I don't know how it got brought up, but the article came out. He told me about this parrot dying, and then I brought it up a little bit later, and he pretended like he forgot that he had just told me. That happened whenever that parrot died. I think that parrot died 9 years ago. Anytime I say the word Alex. Or I bring up parrots or birds, or if I say like, or I'll be like, yeah, well, you know, like Alex. And he goes, what happened to Alex? He pretends like he's forgotten about it every time for the amount of years that Alex has been dead. And then he reacts as if for the first time ever he's hearing about this bird that he cares about deeply dying. And he breaks down and he gets so upset. He goes, I can't believe you just tell me this so nonchalantly. This bird meant everything to me. And so it became such a big thing that we started. I got the book about Alex signed by the author, and I sent it to him. And then he got that, and he goes, "What's this book about? What happened? What happened?" And then 2 days later, he made a tiny coffin. He made a tiny coffin and put real bird feathers in it and blood in it, and left it outside my apartment. And I got there, and it's in a box, and I open it up. And I go, I call him, And I go, did you do this? And I go, do what? And I point to it. He goes, oh, no, was that Alex? And he would, like, set himself up throughout years.
That's amazing.
He's so fun. He's one of the funniest people. One other bit that we've been doing forever is that, oh, someone else, Megan Amram, anytime we talked about how we like John Tesh, and so she signed up for John Tesh's newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
Every John Tesh newsletter she's gotten for the past 10 years, she forwards to me, and then I respond back to her. She forwards it to me, then I forward it back to her as if she'd never seen it before, and say a pun about whatever title is, be like, you're going to love this, whatever. And that's been going on for years also. But Gil, man, he just crushes me. And it's like that guy that has always crushed me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great question to ask. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about Gil.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in and doing this.
This has been so nice. I don't often get to talk about just comedy. So yeah. It's been very, I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
Take care.
All right. Thank you so much to Ben Schwartz for being my guest on this very special 50th episode of The Last Laugh. Sonic the Hedgehog is now playing in theaters nationwide, and Standing Up Falling Down will be in select theaters and on demand starting this Friday, February 21st. Middleditch and Schwartz should be hitting Netflix sometime over the next few months, but if you want to see them live, which you definitely do, you can find tour dates and tickets at middleditchandschwartz.com. If you like this show, please tell your friends and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!